Well, we are thrilled to have everyone here and here for this tonight and this weekend of events. I am absolutely positive that you will have a good time. I'm positive that it will be engaging and it will be intellectually stimulating and challenging. And that's one of the reasons why I invited our speaker, because every time I have a conversation with him, I go away thinking about the world differently. I go away challenged to think more deeply. He's a good friend of mine and a very sharp thinker. So that's ultimately what our winter lecture series is about. It's hosted by Rochester Reformed Presbyterian Church, and it's designed to introduce you to new and exciting research done by young scholars in the Reformed tradition, and then ultimately see how that research applies to you, because it's my firm belief that Christian scholarship, though it's done at a high academic level and though it should apply to the academic world, in the end it has to make its way to regular people in the church. And that's what this lecture series is about. It's an attempt to bridge that divide. So here's the schedule. So from 6 p.m. till about 7:30, Joe's going to give us a lecture tonight, kind of an intro lecture. And then at 9 p.m. at a restaurant right down the street, Limoncello Restaurant, they have graciously given us a room for a poetry reading that deals with the same topic from a different angle, a different perspective. And I would encourage you to do dinner at Limoncello, because the owners have been very gracious to us. And if you tell them, it's the best Italian food, by the way, in Rochester. And if you tell them that you're there for the poetry reading, they'll put you in the room that we're in. And then tomorrow, we're here at 9 a.m., where Joe will finish up from 9 to 12, and then on your own for lunch, and then we'll have a time for discussion, Q&A, after lunch. So a few housekeeping notes. If you've not been in our building before, restrooms are downstairs. If you go down the stairs and around the corner to the basement, we have restrooms down there. There's also child care down there. There's coffee and water in the back, cookies in the back. Feel free to have that. And this is being recorded both via video and audio, so it'll be available later. Also, we did advertise to the deaf community, so we have some gracious interpreters. I don't see anybody as of right now, and they'll just continue to interpret for a little while, and if nobody shows up from that community, then we will not do that. So, now, it's my distinct pleasure to introduce our speaker, Joseph Minnick, who is joined by his lovely and absolutely fantastic wife, Rebecca. They have managed to make their way out to Rochester, New York from Garland, Texas, leaving behind four children with Rebecca's mother, so pray for her. My wife and I are very good friends with Joe and Rebecca. It goes back to our days in seminary, where Joe and I went to seminary together. Joe completed his MA in religion at Reformed Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C., and his thesis was on the topic of infant baptism and its relation to the doctrine of God. And following that work, though I really tried to convince him to go do his PhD at the University of Denver, he instead went to the University of Texas at Dallas. And he's working on his PhD in intellectual history. And his research is what we're going to hear about today and tomorrow. Joe is a regular contributor to the Calvinist International, and he has several articles, conference papers that have been published through that venue. More importantly, Joe is a fantastic scholar, a good friend of mine. He has a brilliant mind and a caring heart, two things that when they go together can make for a really special time. And I couldn't think of anyone I would rather have for this series. And so now I turn the mic over and I offer a warm welcome for the weekend to Joseph Minnick.
I have no idea who he's talking about, to be honest. Well, welcome. I have to begin by saying that I feel extremely honored to have been invited to this event. I mean that in two ways. First, I'm actually quite touched that someone thought me competent enough to talk on any subject for several hours for the next couple of days. And perhaps more importantly, I fear that the honor given to me here is actually extreme. That this is, in fact, my first experience giving any series of lectures, and so I hope that you will not be disappointed or bored. But at the risk of coming up as merely self-deprecating, allow me to balance this flattery of myself with declaring my intention to exploit the situation a bit. What I'm going to present here in seed form are some ideas, though perhaps presented, I hope, in a more pastoral rather than an academic tone, that I nevertheless, at the academic level, want to grow into my dissertation at the University of Texas at Dallas. And so you, my captive audience, can act as my guinea pigs for either making me so insecure that I should find another project or for encouraging me that I should actually continue doing this. So all awkward intros aside, I and my wife Rebecca, who's happily here with me, are very thankful to be invited here for all of your hospitality, and especially to Patrick, Stefan, and Danny for asking us to do this. As Patrick just mentioned, I met him at Reformed Theological Seminary in D.C. in Dr. Howard Griffith's Doctrine of God class. We were on the short list of nerds who would be there a couple of hours early to read, which inevitably developed into our friendship. Of course, we quickly discovered that as impressive as Patrick is, his wife Dani is much better. And I also just want to give a shout out, because they'll probably listen later. I want to give a shout out to my two good, swell atheist friends, Merriman Zajac and David Kotler, who through many years of conversations have shaped significantly my approach to the topic we're addressing today. David, in fact, is an alumni of the University of Rochester. So so on to the topic itself. What I'll be addressing this evening and tomorrow is the problem of the temptation of atheism. And I want to distinguish this at the get-go from several other ways of approaching the question of atheism as a theist generally or as a Christian specifically. My intent here is not as such to argue for the existence of God or to refute atheism. More importantly, my main question is not just a question about or an analysis of atheists. I am most immediately interested in why those who are not atheists can still nevertheless understand why it is that atheism might be plausible to someone. And so let me clarify that for just a moment. There are plenty of persons who are persuaded for all sorts of rational reasons that God exists or that atheism is not just wrong, but deeply and philosophically incoherent. And I count myself among the number of those who believe this. And yet these same persons might confess to you that the atheist vision of an apathetic universe, of a cosmos, which reduces to impersonal forces, nevertheless retains some psychological pull and continues to resurface as an intellectual item which must be dealt with throughout their lives. And if you do not recognize yourself in this sort of experience, then these lectures will possibly be less interesting for you, something like a museum exhibit of interesting or at least pitiable people. For the rest of we poor souls, I'd like to move even more narrowly within the larger question of the plausibility of atheism, and to do so initially by telling a story. I promise not to tell too many stories because I want you to get your money's worth of dry academic or at least pseudo-academic banter. I do recall, however, that this event is free, so for what that's worth. I can tell you a lot of experiences, a lot of stories, which highlight how this issue has come home for me personally, but I think one in particular exposes my own, and I suspect perhaps our general vulnerability. I worked in Rockville, Maryland at the time, and this is about the time I met Patrick at seminary. This is around 2009, I think. And I was driving home listening to NPR, because, of course, listening to NPR is supposed to make you a smart person. Anyway, a radio show was on highlighting a story about agnostic or atheist junior high camp. Christians have all sorts of Bible camps, after all, so why can't we have atheist camp? It's the 21st century. So, in any case, as the story was presented, they interviewed one of the camp's attendees, a bright-sounding young lady of 12 or 13, and after a little of back and forth with the interviewer, this young woman was afforded the opportunity to present one of her skeptical missiles, and it went something like this. And mind you, I am paraphrasing. Quote, "You know, God could totally get rid of atheism if he'd just show up. I mean, think of it. How hard would it be for the Almighty to peel back the clouds every day at 3 o'clock p.m. for God time and say, hey guys, here I am, see ya. If he did that, no atheism. So why doesn't he if we're supposed to believe in him?" Okay. One thing not to do when you're trying to sound smart to an audience is to admit that the juvenile musings of a 12-year-old girl at agnostic camp actually made you feel a little bit dumb. Something like Moses doing his serpent thing in front of Pharaoh's wizards. But I was hit. A seminary student who does nothing but think about religion and atheism, schooled by a 12-year-old at atheist camp on the radio. Of course, the story doesn't end there. My world didn't come colliding down. I had all the typical intellectual and not-so-intellectual reactions, ranging from reasons why, of course, I knew that God existed, to more self-assuring reactions that, of course, such reasoning was juvenile. But the point of the story is not to talk about my own psychology. It is rather to highlight where I suspect a lot of us are at. Now, I suspect that this little dart hits a lot of us in the gut. And what I want to explore this evening and tomorrow is why that is. Specifically, and we could explore this topic in many ways, but specifically, why does divine absence bother us precisely in relationship to this question? Why does the fact that God does not show up in a certain concrete manner have any relevance for the question of his existence? That we don't see him when we pray, that he often seems distant, that sometimes our prayers bounce off the ceiling, and especially for suffering people, that sometimes we can beg for him to just show himself to us, and he doesn't. All of this causes us to feel, or at least be tempted to feel, that maybe his non-existence is the most natural inference. Sometimes the universe, our experiences, and we could even get more concrete, we could say our marriages, our relationships, feel as though they are lived out in the face of a deafening divine silence, and therefore a divine vacuum, all reduced to an indifferent cosmos, deaf to our prayers, joys, and pains. And of course, I say sometimes. That this, of course, could all be qualified, but my goal here is to acknowledge, and like the psalmist, to give utterance to those moments where it is barely qualified. Those moments where belief, even in the basic notion that God is at all, feels difficult, and feels difficult for precisely these reasons. So I want to make one final preliminary comment and then give a broad outline of these three lectures, followed by actually getting into the meat of the first one. The final preliminary comment is this. We need to recognize the distinctive historical character of the problem as I've stated it. Persons have always struggled with divine absence in various forms, and there is a significant degree of continuity between the psalmist's "Where are you, God?" and our own struggles with atheism. But there is also a significant difference, to wit, neither the psalmist or the ancient Near Eastern pagan, the medieval Catholic, the ancient starving Chinese peasant, thought that their unanswered cries to the silent sky had any relevance to the question of whether or not God exists. That God existed was an obvious truth written into the fabric of basic phenomenological and social experience. Now, Charles Taylor helps us to understand the significance of the modern condition in his magisterial book, A Secular Age. Taylor argues that in the Middle Ages, for instance, we have a moment in which disbelief in God was simply not plausible. It is not that one could not ask the question of whether God existed or not technically, as Thomas Aquinas does in his Summa Theologica, but it is that no one's belief in God was suspended atop understanding Thomas's arguments. Even if his arguments were all refuted, it was still obvious, in some very relevant sense, that God existed. What has changed now is not, Taylor argues, that we can no longer believe in God. We can still believe in God. We can find reasons for God rationally compelling. But what it is like to believe, the experience of believing, is the experience of taking one option among many in respect to the God question. Not believing in God is plausible. That is, it actually has a pull. It's a living option in the taxonomy of William James, even if we reject that option. This is profoundly important for our analysis. To live in a world in which belief is felt to be one living option among many is simply to live in a world in which an alternative belief system is very possibly, at least psychologically, plausible to us or somehow faintly understandable to us in a way that it simply wasn't to many of our ancestors. For our purposes, I'll leave aside the question of whether or not there are precedents for the distinctive character of modern atheism in ancient Western philosophy or in other traditions. My own sense is that most of these so claimed as precedent were front-loaded with metaphysical doctrines that most modern atheists in the West would consider, on the face of it, quasi-religious. But this does not necessarily matter for anything else we're going to be talking about. We can at least agree that this atheist option has not been a living option in recent memory in the West, and that now it is. For all intents and purposes, our problematic is a modern one, and that is, how is it possible that A, we can think we have compelling reasons to believe in God, B, even find atheism to be incoherent or obviously false in many ways, and yet C, still feel that it's a living option? Said a little differently, why does it sometimes feel like it takes great effort to believe things about reality that are supposed to be so obvious, as though we're holding on to it by an act of will rather than by a passive sense of its obviousness, the way, for instance, that it doesn't take a great act of will for you to believe that I'm speaking to you right now? And why is the simple fact of divine absence even relevant to such a question, rather than a triviality which is related to other questions like, you know, why doesn't God intrude when you know, in evil or something like that? But somehow this absence seems to have special relevance for questions concerning God's existing at all. What I'd like to do tonight is to think more carefully about the simple fact of this problem, as well as to give a sampling of its inflection from a variety of sources. I would also like to entertain several interpretations of this phenomenon and give you reasons why I think those interpretations are inadequate. What I then hope to do tomorrow morning is to explore what is, in my judgment, a more proper historical and philosophical response to the phenomenon that we're talking about. And as I said earlier, my intention is not necessarily apologetical in these lectures. I'm not focused on proving the existence of God or something like this. But I will need to clarify tomorrow morning in the first lecture why someone might find claims for God's existence to be rationally persuasive, and yet to query why it is that it has often been compelling without them, and why it is not now compelling even with them. The effect of this analysis, I'll argue, will have a deflationary for the atheist option. By this I mean that the argument I'll offer tomorrow, I hope, will help us to understand both why atheism might feel plausible, and why its plausibility might have little to do with its being warranted or true. And so finally, tomorrow afternoon, following this earlier lecture, I hope to ask what a particularly Christian analysis of the situation might be. So what should we do now? Should we seek to move back to a situation where this plausibility problem wasn't a problem at all? Or are there resources within the Christian tradition for offering an alternative response, rather than sort of nostalgic longing for the past? Indeed, from a Christian perspective, is the current situation more an opportunity than a problem? And I'm going to argue that indeed it is more an opportunity than a problem, but that's all for later. For now, let's get inside this problem a little more holistically. And so, I want to give a smattering of evidence that divine absence, the simple fact that God's being and activity are not as immediately obvious as the fact that I'm speaking to you right now, is perceived by many moderns to be a problem. And because of this, belief is often portrayed as a great intellectual and spiritual effort, whereas unbelief is tacitly felt to be the default intellectual position once we, to bastardize a psalm, cease striving and know that there is no God. So a few general observations are in order. In the last century, there have been many books in the philosophical community on the themes related to the meaning of presence, often the presence of the transcendental, which is, they have an almost sermonic flavor. Examples are George Steiner's Real Presences. There's a similar book of that title by Jacques Ellul. There are similar themes in the works of Roger Scruton and Charles Taylor. A tendency toward a view of religion which explicitly addresses the absence of God and seeks to climb some phenomenological mountain to behold, or in technobabble, to awe-behold with apathetic wonder, the line between the lines, Heidegger's betweenness, Levinas' face, Rudolf Otto's holy, that we know not what, that is perhaps best identified, as one of my pals puts it, as woe. Not being able to take presence for granted, there have been a dearth of popular religious works on doubt, now trying to kind of recontextualize what doubt is, on doubt as a virtue rather than a vice, alongside a large amount of popular works on epistemology and proving the existence of God. Indeed, enough interest in apologetics to get the impression that the status of one's belief might actually depend upon it. Whether stated with confident feeling or not, God does not appear, given these things, to be also obvious. Not that it is innate in apologetics, but as such, but the ethos of much recent apologetics is demonstrably kind of anxious, an attempt at a sort of intellectual therapy for the vulnerable. One does not, after all, write a bunch of books on proving the existence of what is taken for granted, such as chairs, relationships, or the movie Ghostbusters. And where apologetic strategy for coping with God's absence is abandoned, there are many recent attempts to carve out a space for a more subtle religion by an argument for religious experience or consciousness, for a kind of delighted ambiguity. Surely we can just hold on to this one thing, this one little slice of our inaccessible subjectivity. What I want to note here is precisely the sense of just preserving this one little thing. One gets the impression that for many persons, human thought has chipped away at this and that religious fantasy, and that many religious persons have retreated to a smaller and smaller corner. In the final analysis, can we not just preserve our own experience, our own sense that we participate in an absolute beauty? Or must we reduce even this to the goings-on of naturally selected neurons, which ultimately themselves reduce to the accidents of collapsed quantum waves? It is precisely because this is the perceived situation that much apologetics writing could be seen as a sort of strategic attempt to take back an area that was taken away. Now, whether it be fighting evolution with intelligent design in six-day creationism, fighting relativism with absolute truth, reason with revelation, naturalism with philosophy, neutrality with presuppositionalism. And yet arguably, what none of these attempts get to, at least essentially, is the very sense of fragility itself. Assumed and at stake in these debates, arguably, is the felt fragility of our deepest identities and truths, which are then surrounded by hedges of argument, apologetics, and practice. This felt fragility is manifest, I'd argue, in many deconversion narratives, which fascinatingly in our culture often work in the following way. Someone converts from the very complex set of claims that is Christianity all the way to atheism in one fell swoop. It is actually not as common, and it used to be more common, but it's not as common these days from what I can tell for people to land in the middle. So to convert from Christianity to, say, to deism or just some pared down dogma, something like this. But there's a sense in the modern discussion that at stake are whole systems. And this means that not only is the center vulnerable, inaccessible subjectivity, religious experience, etc., but the whole structure can feel like a delicate house of cards, wherein the foundational card is not so much protected by all the other cards around it as rendered exponentially more vulnerable for having so many areas of exposure. God's existence then isn't just felt to depend upon Aquinas. In some cases, it's dependent upon whether the Bible can be falsified, whether the resurrection happened, or whether Moses wrote Genesis. To lose belief in this context often feels very much like a letting go or coming to terms with what can really be known and counted on. This dynamic is hauntingly portrayed in the relatively recent film Higher Ground, which is the directorial debut of Vera Farmiga, for those who are into film. This film is based upon Carolyn S. Briggs' autobiographical account of her own loss of faith, entitled The Dark World, A Memoir of Salvation Found and Lost. And the film does not portray an intellectually or spiritually rebellious woman who quits the church because it was mean. It actually portrays a woman desperate to experience God, desperate to know all things are in his control, desperate just to know that he is there. And what is she met with? Silence. Silence when she suffers spiritual abuse. Silence when her friend decays from cancer. Silence when her marriage falls apart. Her eventual loss of faith is not felt or portrayed to be a decision, but more like a chaste wind that ultimately gets away from her. In short, it simply stops what her faith is rooted in, simply stops seeming real or plausible at all. Another version of this can be found in the surprisingly deep film, The Gray. You're supposed to only mention indie films if you want to be cool, but whatever. The Gray, starring Liam Neeson. In this film, a fairly rustic group of oil men are in a plane crash in the middle of the Alaskan wilderness. Perhaps many of you have seen it. And like many films of this sort, the better portion of the film involves their attempt to escape various dangers like wolves. What makes the film unique, however, are the explicit theological conversations that go on between the characters. Many of them are religious, the characters, but Nielsen, who had previously watched as his wife slowly decline from cancer, while actually quite sympathetic to the impulse to believe, nevertheless cannot bring himself, and that's just how I'd want to say it, he can't even get into a place where he can believe even for cathartic reasons. For him, it would apparently be dishonest. The disaster scenario and its beautiful surrounding scenery is a perfect way to communicate a universe that is at once full of wonder, but also full of hostility, the balance of which is the cosmos's utter indifference to these small Homo sapiens fumbling around in the snow. At the film's climax, Nielsen looks up into the sky and screams in frustration, "Do something! Do something!" You phony, fraudulent curse words that are uncouth for here. Come on, prove it. No faith, earn it. Show me something real. I need it now, not later. Now, show me, and I'll believe in you to the day I die. I'm calling on you. And the sky is silent. A tough Irishman, Nielsen, stands up and says, "Screw it, I'll do it myself." And yet, doing it oneself does not always work in the indifferent cosmos. Perhaps no film has captured an indifferent cosmos better than that incredibly beautiful but incredibly disturbing art piece by Lars von Trier, Melancholia, aptly titled. It is, in fact, incredibly depressing. The film opens at a wedding, but a wedding that is oppressively brooding. It is not for a while that the film-viewing audience realizes that the scene, which is supposed to be joyful, is juxtaposed to the wedding participants' awareness that a comet is coming toward Earth and is likely to kill all living persons. And so the rest of the film post-wedding portrays the bride and her sister in a cottage, preparing to see if the comet will strike the Earth or slingshot around it. And so the full film is full of waiting. Once it becomes clear that the comet will strike, the sisters build a little teepee in a field, sit in it with their children, and they wait. The film is interspersed with incredible scenes of natural beauty, of cosmic wonder, but also with just absolute, absolute, absolute indifference. At all the joys and strife of human sentience will pass like a moment, like a breath, into the void of the cosmic sea. This vision is disturbing, perhaps, to some of us, and yet it is not felt, though perhaps thought, it is not felt by most of us to be insane. It is haunting, and the fact that it has this pull can cause us to question everything. How can I be so certain that this cosmic indifference is not the case? Indeed, just staring at the vastness... Just staring at the vastness of the cosmos, juxtaposed to the smallness of the human mind, I wonder at how I can make any confident pronouncements at all, that we and I am scandalously particular and limited and finite. And yet, I'll argue tomorrow that there is a sort of religious sentiment here, and that Nietzsche's defiant affirmation of a life his defiant affirmation of life, that his ability to stare nihilism in the face and say, okay, and still receive it as beautiful. Now, this is itself a sort of religious posture. Indeed, I will argue a sort of covert atheist version of pure actuality. Basically, atheists are cheating, but we'll talk about that tomorrow. When the atheist option became a bit more popular among intellectuals in the mid to late 19th century, it is fascinating to note how much of it had in a sort of aesthetic and existential appeal. Atheism could stare nature red in tooth and claw, and yet simply wonder at its vastness, simply receive it in its most basic and unfiltered terms, with, again, a simple gratitude that human life was at all. Who cares where it comes from? Who cares if it's all just atoms banging together? It is. And what can one do but smile at this happy accident and enjoy it? The virtues required to appreciate this are sort of honesty and a bravery. It is the intellectually and existentially brave who can do this. Here we see the appeal of this viewpoint as not just an intellectual honesty for its own sake, but perhaps an even slightly self-indulgent self-evaluation that I'm able to take it. This makes the view even more attractive. Not only do we see striving, but we feel a sort of pure and basic level of cosmic wonder, and can feel the dignity of being honest and brave with reality as it coldly presents itself to us. It is indifferent, but we are not. We are those creatures who look back at it and say, I love you. Who cares if it doesn't mean anything ultimately? Who cares if this is not founded on absolute truth, this trope that we throw around? This is a joyous posture. This is perceived by many to be a very joyous posture towards reality. It's freedom, and it's freeing, and it's to be lost in the wonder of reality. I want to come back to this phenomenon later, but what I want to do for the moment is to allow us to admit to ourselves, if we dare, some degree of attractiveness about this option. An attractiveness which might be a bit self-indulgent and navel-gazing, sure, but it can't quite be reduced to these things. This is important for what will become my critique tomorrow, because I don't think we can fully understand what is going on in modern atheism at best unless we understand its aesthetic appeal as more than just the shallow stereotype of I'm an atheist because then I'm able to do whatever I want. That's not a fair reading of a lot of atheists or a lot of atheism. It is far more than this. Its fundamental ethic, again, at its best, there's not best versions as well, is one of honesty and a commitment to affirm life in its most basic fashion. We need not torture ourselves with the odd particulars of dogma, but we can simply affirm the simplest things, that we are here after all, and that we must make do on this terrestrial ship in the vast cosmic sea. Indeed, in its modern form, atheism tends to terminate in an ethic similar to that which we find in John Lennon's justly famous song, Imagine. We've all heard this song many, many times, I suspect. And for all the ways that we could critique this song, and people do critique this song, one of my friends just recently posted on Facebook that it wasn't a good song, and I was very offended. But for all the ways we could critique this song, who is not moved, except for my friend, by its simple, pleasant melody, which presents to us its simple, pleasant vision of our potential as humans on Earth? I dare say that it's nearly impossible for it not to strike some sort of chord in us. You know, this emphasis on the brotherhood of man, a world in which people care more about the good of their neighbor than the privilege of their nation. But included for Lenin is this phrase, imagine there's no heaven, which is not so striking as this follow-up phrase, it's easy if you try. And that latter phrase makes it a very, very modern song, that it's in fact easy to imagine there's no heaven. Perhaps some of you can already detect, and we'll say again more about this tomorrow, that my interpretation of what I've just described is there is a somewhat quasi or fundamentally religious character to it. That sense that I can stare at reality and say, whoa, is not simply explained by God, but is irreducibly a religious posture. That before which we say, whoa, is that which we perceive to be bigger than us. That in which we are caught up, grounded in, and it's representative of forces which transcend our ordinary experience, and which indeed, not to put a too fine a point on it, give those experiences to us. One presumably liberating feature of this simple posture and its simplicity is its simplicity and its clarity. In contrast to this, faith, especially Christian faith and all its attendant dogmas, often feels like something that we hold on to for dear life. The simplicity of this posture versus this complex, oh, we have to believe all these items in the creed, the virgin birth. Faith feels like something we hold on to for dear life, but which ultimately eludes us. I recall a local Catholic, Roman Catholic convert from Roman Catholicism to agnosticism in the Maryland area, a very smart guy named Greg, who wrote about his story of becoming an agnostic. And as I recall, he used the image of his faith losing steam. It was not that he didn't want to believe. He would in fact say, I wish I could believe. He came to a point where he simply did not and could not, according to his own words. Despite his best efforts, he would say, he wrote as though he were effectively dragged into unbelief. And I would say that description is not a particularly uncommon phenomenon. Perhaps you, and certainly I, have met many atheists who tell a very similar story about their conversion from belief to atheism or agnosticism or some other ism. Perhaps no one better described this than one of the 20th century's great novelists, John Updike. Toward the beginning of his book, In the Beauty of the Lilies, the Presbyterian minister, Clarence Wilmot, I want to say the book is set in the 1920s or so. So Presbyterian minister Clarence Wilmot is described as feeling, quote, the last particles of his faith leave him. The sensation was distinct. A visceral surrender, a set of dark sparkling bubbles escaping upward, end quote. Updike says later, quote, Clarence's mind was like a many-legged, wingless insect that had long and tediously been struggling to climb up the walls of a slick porcelain basin, and now a sudden, impatient wash of water swept it down the drain. There is no God, end quote. Clarence is stunned in this moment, but Updike continues, quote, actually I'm going to drink here before I read this quote because it's a long one. Thank you. So Updike continues, sort of expounding on Clarence Wilmot's new unbelief. Life's sounds all rang with a curious lightness and flatness, as if a resonating bass beneath them had been removed. They told Clarence Wilmot what he had long suspected, that the universe was utterly indifferent to his states of mind, as empty of divine content as a corroded kettle. All its metaphysical content had leaked away but for cruelty and death, which without the hypothesis of a God became unmetaphysical. They became simply facts, which oblivion would in time obliviously erase. Oblivion became a singular comforter. The cliff-like riddle of predestination. How can man have free will without impinging upon God's perfect freedom? How can God condemn man when all his acts from Alpha to Omega are his very own? Simply evaporated. An immense strain of justification was at a blow lifted. The former believer's habitual mental contortions decisively relaxed. And yet the depths of vacancy revealed were appalling. In the purifying sweep of atheism, human beings lost all special value. The numb misery of the horse was matched by that of the farmer. The once green ferny lives crushed into coals. I've never been able to say this word right. Fossiliferous, I think that's right. Strata were no more anonymous and obliterated than Clarence's own life would soon be. In a wink of Earth's tremendous time, without biblical blessing, the physical universe became sheerly horrible and disgusting. All fleshly acts became vile rather than merely some. The reality of men slaying lambs and cattle, fish and fowl to sustain their own bodies took on an aspect of grisly comedy. the blood-soaked selfishness of a cosmic mayhem. The thought of eating sickened Clarence. His body felt swollen in its entirety, like an ankle after a sprain, and he scarcely dared take a step, lest he topple from his ungainly height. End quote. I love especially that bit about his new relationship to his body. It would be fascinating to compare that to Updike's justly famous and extremely medical and clinical poem on the resurrection of Christ, which if you have not read, is I commend to you. In any case, note what we see here. Clarence is not portrayed as leaving the faith. He did not refuse to believe. Faith and unbelief left him the way strength leaves the body. His will is portrayed as no more involved in losing this belief than is your will in affirming that I am here right now. You could hardly disbelieve that even if you wanted to. And at least in the portrayal of the novel, Clarence could not believe even if he did want to. Indeed, he laments his loss of faith at several points in the book, desperately wishing it was all true. And yet the world seemed utterly different than the claims of faith. And so faith, rather than unbelief, was rendered an act of will and stubbornness, its absence the honest surrender to reality that it actually, as it actually seemed. And is this not how it can feel? That to believe is to sort of add something to those undeniable features of reality that we all agree upon, the common banality that we all recognize, to suffuse the cosmos with agency and intention and personality is felt to see to be something I must try to see rather than what is obvious to me otherwise. So before I move on to giving my own account of what I think the main thing is in this situation as I've described it, I want to briefly entertain a few attempted explanations of this phenomenon, explain why I think they're ultimately defective, at least for the specific question before us, and then briefly state my own theses, which I hope to unpack tomorrow. And so, interpretation one of this phenomenon. Perhaps the most obvious explanatory device for this, for what I've just described is, well, these claims are plausible. The atheist option is plausible because the atheist option is the right one. It's not an unfair, interpretation. I will spend more time on this claim tomorrow. Primarily arguing for why I think God is necessary and necessarily personal, while also hoping to explain why the atheist option can still feel natural and plausible to us. Nevertheless, I think we can offer a few preliminary responses along the following lines. Sometimes, things seem plausible or obvious, which are actually not so plausible or obvious. The instinct which says, oh boy, this is obviously the truth, and now we're going to spend a whole day tomorrow giving excuses for why we're avoiding the obvious truth, I think is a misguided response, instinct or reaction. I can't force anybody not to have that reaction. But I think there's some prima facie reasons to be careful here. For instance, there are those who have thought about this who are demonstrably intellectually honest and brave, and yet who are firmly persuaded that God exists and that he's the rewarder of those who seek him. Frankly, I think a denial that such persons exist is either ignorant, dishonest, or can be dismissed as merely polemical, and insecurely so. Many atheists do confess, in fact. Indeed, I would argue that the most intellectually honest atheists can actually struggle with belief just as we struggle with unbelief. That is, they can lie awake at night and wonder if there is personality, after all, behind the scenes. What is more, they can understand at their best why someone might take that option. Thomas Nagel is an interesting recent example of this that's in this category. And again, I'm speaking only of the most informed and the best atheists, not necessarily what many might call their juvenile counterparts. Atheists who live in a world in which God is a living option and in which they can imagine what it is like to think of reality differently. Another consideration, as I began to say earlier, is that some things can seem plausible or obvious, which on reflection are not so plausible or obvious. Atheists necessarily agree with this as it pertains to their medieval ancestors, for almost all of whom atheism was fantastically implausible. commonly agreed upon historical examples are also that it used to be very plausible to think that the sun revolved around the earth. It was very plausible to the history of Aristotelianism that no species of animal could go extinct. In fact, a lot of Aristotelians had a kind of crisis when they discovered dinosaur bones, because their view was that no form could be without an instance. So they had to adjust when they discovered, well, in fact, things do go extinct. Or pundits and people who argued that Donald Trump could not possibly become the Republican nominee for the President of the United States. Current examples, those are historic examples. Current examples include the common but clearly inadequate reduction, I think many would argue, of gender to be entirely a social construct. The belief that religion always masks deeper motivations whenever someone commits an act of evil in the name of religion. Or the implausible fact that we now live in a world in which Donald Trump is the president-elect of the United States of America. A second way to grapple this with the phenomenon we are describing is one which reduces all of these atheist temptations and conversions, and this is sort of the other side, the alter ego of this first option, an interpretation which reduces all of these atheists and temptations and conversions to a problem of the mind or a problem of the will. Basically, people are tempted by or convert to atheism because they have bad ideas, or they are tempted by and convert to atheism because they have a distorted will. With respect to the former, the fix is normally to correct their ideas by persuading the temptee of truths and perspectives which will presumably take away the plausibility of atheism. With respect to the latter, the argument is often that we have a sinful will which opposes God and therefore have a great interest in God not existing. After all, if he doesn't exist again, I can do whatever I want. These persons are therefore unable to be honest with reality that God exists in this case, because they want a lie to be true. I don't want to deny that there's truth in each of these observations, or that there are many examples which could fit each of those instances, but the same could be said the other way around. Are there believers who simply believe because God is a crutch for them, because they are afraid of the alternative, or for reasons other than true confidence, conviction, and clarity? And I think the answer is, of course there are people who fit that description. But this is not true of all, and perhaps even the average believer in God. Similarly, I don't think the above adequately accounts for the atheist temptation on the whole. And so thinking in terms of the mind, for instance, there are again many persons who are quite persuaded of the case for theism or Christianity for precisely the same reason that the objector is, but who still have difficulty shaking the possibility that atheism is true. This is common, and we need to account for and minister to it. And with respect to the will, this interpretation that the will is the problem, while it is true that human beings, as we will explore more tomorrow, are in ethical tension with God, this does not necessarily manifest itself in denying his existence or even in denying Christian theology. The demons believe, says James, but they shudder. Presumably they have distorted wills. Presumably there are Westminster confessing reprobates. While our tension with God might and does cause us to distort reality, this does not account for the whole phenomenon, nor the fact that this is experienced by believers who are pursuing God, are in a right relationship with him, as a very real temptation, but despite constant thought and constant prayer. I just argue that this is simply a reality, and it needs to be explained better than that, in my judgment. I think it's important to reflect a little bit more about this particular option, this particular reaction, that it's a problem of distorted mind and will. That's the only reason somebody could be tempted by this. I think it's a fairly common reaction. Behind it is often a theology which implies that one cannot believe Christian truth apart from conversion, and therefore that any struggle with Christian truth must reflect either the lack of conversion or the post-conversion approximation of lack of conversion and remaining unbelief. I would say this is a deeply problematic claim because it inevitably reduces the persuasiveness and objective truth of Christian claims to a state of converted, the subjectivity of the converted person. even if Christ was raised from the dead in real history, our persuasion that he was raised from the dead is entirely dependent upon the right subjective starting point, a sort of special set of reality glasses, which are then not publicly accessible. This, therefore, pushes Christian claims, qua their common reality, out of their public vulnerability, or I would argue their public strength, and into the subject. And this is what William Bartley would call a retreat to commitment. In my judgment, this strategy is very common, but it is very toxic to Christian confidence. I have similar concerns about apologetic attempts concerning, and we can get into these in the Q&A, by the way. I'm sure much of this could be qualified. But I wrote these with very strong feelings, so this is the unqualified raw version. I have similar concerns about apologetic attempts concerning an objective basis for morality or some other philosophical parallel, as though moral experience is subjective and that we need to go then and go find an objective ground. It seems rather the opposite. Moral space just is the reality of our shared world, and in both its whole and in its particulars, it echoes a divine original. And this can be shown. It is precisely the public nature of our claims that tests their strength and demonstrates their resilience. I actually wrote this down here as well. Perhaps we can clarify this in the Q&A session tomorrow. But for now, I'd want to insist that for all the ways in which subjective states might render a thing plausible or implausible, we are still fundamentally in a shared reality, a shared world, a shared space in which we are all trying to make our way, and with at least some shared grounds upon which we can try to persuade one another. And it is into this very real shared space that Christ really came and really stood in front of people's faces. It is into this shared space that he rose from the dead. And it is in this shared space, in reality, real, hardcore, brass tacks, concrete, steel, blood, sweat, and tears and pain reality, that we can still confidently proclaim that Jesus is the risen Lord of this world. And for precisely this reason, it is also in this very public shared space that these shared struggles, which we are attempting to elucidate, can be ministered to by him. And that's for the second lecture tomorrow. Let me be extra clear, nevertheless, that I'm not mainly speaking here about, that I am mainly speaking here about public persuasion concerning truth claims as such. I am not speaking of the human heart or conversion, which ultimately has to do with the evaluation of truth claims that goes beyond their mere truth. Again, the demons believe that God is one, but their evaluation of this makes them shudder. Changing this deeper evaluation is ultimately a work of the Spirit. And while it does ordinarily attend persuasion concerning the truths themselves, and therefore renders our attempts at persuasion evangelistic to some extent, intellectual persuasion and proper evaluation of what we can be persuaded of, these are in principle separate things. It's the difference between saying that this is true and that I evaluate it as good for me. I want it. Summing up here a little bit, I just want to give a summary of tomorrow to whet your appetite and hopefully to get you to come back. I will try to do this by leaving you with two questions, one for each lecture. In my first lecture tomorrow, I will try to explain both why I think a sort of Aristotelian Thomist argument for God works, why, in my judgment, it proves the existence of a personal God, but why I think atheism, in spite of that, can still feel persuasive. Why is that? It is because our tacit sense of reality has been shaped, though not entirely so, and this is important, but it has been shaped by modern technological culture. Basically, in the first lecture tomorrow, we're going to talk largely about technology. And the question I want to leave you with as we approach this lecture is, let me back up so that you hear the question. Question number one for lecture tomorrow. what does the modern technological order suggest about what it means for a thing to be real at all? So let me try that again. What does the modern technological order suggest to us day in and day out, tacitly and explicitly, what it means for a thing to be real, to exist, to be present at all? I think that if we ask and answer this question, we will significantly deflate, but not totally eradicate, our own temptations toward atheism. And in my second lecture tomorrow, I will argue, Lord willing, but here we are. We are where we are, and the question becomes what our calling is in precisely this ideological context, where we can believe this and still be tempted by this other option. Since I've argued that this temptation is a radically contingent one and highly related to our particular historical moment and culture, the question becomes what we should do about this. One popular option is to say that we should get back or get forward to a world which is more like the medieval era, at least in this respect. I'm going to argue by contrast that the modern situation, despite this temptation, but despite these pressures on our faith, is actually in some ways an improved situation for the modern believer rather than a hindrance. And the question which I hope will open this up for us is the following. So question two for the second lecture tomorrow. How interested is God in people merely believing in his existence? So again, that question for lecture two tomorrow. How interested is God that people merely believe that he exists? I believe that asking and answering that question will bring us quickly into distinctively Christian territory and a uniquely Christian perspective on human freedom and faith. And so I hope you'll join us then. That's all for now. Thanks. Yeah, we can take a few minutes if you want. I mean, what I might wind up doing, and I'll just do this until Patrick tells me to shut up. What I might do is try to answer any preliminary questions. It might be that I'll say blah, 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 and I'll talk about that more tomorrow. And if I don't talk about it more tomorrow, obviously as well tomorrow afternoon, there is a more extended Q&A session. And I don't promise that I'll have answers for all of your questions either. So, but feel free to, I'm going to pull this out so because I tend to write when people ask questions just so I make sure that I remember what you asked. So any thoughts, questions, queries, any other adjective that is the same as question?
Well, in your last statement, you said merely believe God. Merely, how interested is God in that we merely believe?
Right.
By merely, you just mean intellectual assent, right?
Yeah. Does God exist or not? Yes, he does. How interested is God in that by itself, you might say. There you go. All right. Other thoughts? Queries? Sure.
So you mentioned that Taylor and how he separates, what's so separate about the church in your moment that Christian belief is down to one option of many. But does he even go further than that? And what you have that was unique about our moment is that not only is it
right. He, and I'm not probably going to remember everything in that book. It's big. I think you're correct. I know certainly that Taylor does argue particularly for the implausibility of certain Christian dogmas. For instance, his discussion of the atonement, I recall that he just finds a sort of Anselmian sort of historic Protestant doctrine of the atonement radically implausible in the modern age. But my hunch is yes, that you're right, that he would argue that the pressures. So I did argue I did say here that an atheist could struggle with belief just as much as we struggle with unbelief, but they're not equal. It's at least true that they're not equal, that the selective pressures, if you will, cultural pressures, are far more, to some extent, toward the side of unbelief. Yes, basically, this strikes me as something he would say, that the option of faith it's still an option, but it's a hard one. It's a difficult one. And again, that would also depend upon what we mean by faith. I think Taylor, he talks about this sort of Nova effect. You know, there's sort of, we're talking in terms of faith and unbelief, but there's really many bits on the spectrum. The more you get toward sort of a historic Christian orthodoxy full of dogmas, the less plausible that is in the modern world. You know, the more you get to kind of a pared down, like, God is love, or something like that, and that's about it. That's maybe a little more palatable. No, so I could give you a reading of that. My sense is that that's a plausible claim. That would not surprise me at all if that were the case. And the reason that would not surprise me at all if it were the case is that still, even though the atheist option is a significant pressure, it's not a particularly common position still. So it is much more common than it's been in the recent history of the West. But most persons in America, my suspicion is even most persons in Europe, even if they don't attend church, if they don't, you know, go through any religious exercises, still have maybe some really basic, like, does God exist or not? Well, yeah, maybe, probably, there's some spiritual force out there. That's still a pretty common position even in America. So to convert to atheism, to atheism or something like hardcore agnosticism, in our context, usually is not something you receive from your parents still. It might be something that you confronted at school, but it actually takes, in our context, interest in the subject. It takes going through perhaps some degree of, it might not take something super impressive. When we say, like, more gullible than less gullible, that might be two groups of very unimpressive levels of gullibility, right? So it might be saying something equivalent to, this 7-year-old draws better than this 5-year-old. That might be true, and that's plausible. But so in assessing gullibility there, but my guess is that it's just common because it's still not usually a default option that you grow up with. And so to come to that option normally is just going to happen to people who are, it's kind of a selection problem there. This is just normally going to happen to people who are inquisitive in nature, interested in, you know, claims concerning reality and that sort of thing. But you could imagine a world in which it was the opposite. So, for instance, perhaps in, this is just a guess, but perhaps in, say, communist Russia, perhaps to believe in God in that context was actually to be a less gullible person, because to or to have particularly a robust Christian faith, because it would actually take, you might very well have been raised without it, and it would take a significant degree of intellectual acumen or inquisitiveness to move to that position. So maybe a better, I think that's probably accounted for just by the context within which atheism is happening. My guess is if you wanted to do an interesting statistic would be to measure the gullibility of, say, people converting actually from sort of agnosticism or atheism to some sort of historic orthodoxy, even if it were Islam, Christianity, Judaism, and those who converted from one of those to atheism. And my guess would be, and I could be wrong, but my guess would be that the gullibility level wouldn't be that much different between the two of those. But that would be selecting for very different types of samples than I think most studies make or something. I don't know if that addresses your question at all. Oh, yeah, there you go. There you go. There you go. Yes. Yeah, that's a really interesting observation. Yeah, my sense would be, certainly, that a lot of narratives, a lot of my friends, I'd say, who I've talked to who've converted to atheism, would certainly have a sort of set of intellectual reasons for being an atheist, just like a lot of us think we have good, handy intellectual reasons for being theists or Christians. But often the kind of motivation to begin even asking the questions, which then become those intellectual positions, are personal experiences. It very often can be death. I know of exceptions on both sides. There are those who seem to be fairly mind driven, but in fact, most of the time when you read these accounts, they're very much bound up with stories. They tend to be stories. I'm not sure those things are, you know, personal experience, intellectual endeavor, not necessarily in conflict with one another. Being a Christian because of personal experience and for intellectual reasons, those can reinforce one another in many ways. And I think that's just part of the dynamic of being a human being. One thing I'd say, and I will cryptically hint at this a little bit tomorrow, is that I do think that personal experiences, one thing that they do, one way they affect us, is they sometimes break up, distort, they shove up into our face a sense of reality and a sense of things that is different than maybe the way we thought it was. So personal experience might not just be I had a feeling about God and therefore I believe he exists, or God didn't help me so I don't think he exists. I actually do think that sometimes it can be he's not helping me, so what does that mean about reality? It actually brings into question creates the inquisitiveness itself by kind of breaking our sense of the way the world's supposed to work apart. So one thing I'll say tomorrow briefly, and I'll say it here now because it's very brief. Very often religious conversions very often attend confrontations with death, and they very often attend confrontations with loving people, interestingly. And I don't think that that's just because people had a psychological experience and that's it. It's that death and love are forces that make us rethink the world. The world, a lot of the way we can perceive reality doesn't quite account for what's going on when we confront those forces. And therefore, that sort of cracks open, that kind of can crack open our lenses. And then sort of different signals of reality can get through. And that might take the form of, well, maybe I should take these, maybe I should then, you know, take why people believe in God a little more seriously. And then they might go study it and realize, oh, actually, that's reasonable. Often, I think, in discussions between theists and atheists, the sense of just how implausible God is or how implausible atheism is so strong that it's very difficult to even analyze the argument. Often it takes something like that personal experience to get into the position, I think, to begin to like honestly say, oh, well, maybe I should actually calm down for a second and listen to this argument and see if it works. So, yes. Yeah, I'll try tomorrow, and I warn you, the first lecture tomorrow will be a little more dense than I hoped it would be, but in that lecture I do hope to address, in very basic overview, how I think basically certain technological advances and the plausibility of atheism tend to go together. So, I will try to address that. There are sources which do it more thoroughly than I will. Mine will be a paragraph or so, but I will try to make that more clear. Yeah, I'd have to think. I don't know. I don't have an immediate intuition or sense of the relationships between those two conversations. My own attempt to read through these things is much more united to, is much more tied to, the link between technological advancement and the way that that's shaped culture. And obviously that would at least be indirectly related to, the discovery of a lot of the world, the translation of sources, I mean, all the things that are going on in the 19th century that produce the study of religion. How atheism is situated, is one paradigm next to all of those, is making religion, certainly making religion this kind of distinct category. I'm not sure. Basically the answer is I'm not sure. So I will not address it tomorrow. Sorry. Yeah. So some of that is personal encounter. Certainly Thomas Nagel will, he has this kind of famous quote where he's saying, it bothers me that some of the smartest people I know believe in God. I mean, he does not just reduce that to, these people are dumb or, some evolutionary, sort of faith gene or something like that. Dawkins and the new, actually... another one maybe ever so slightly in the right moments, because he has contradictory moments. I actually suspect that there are moments where Christopher Hitchens speaks a little bit in this voice. A lot of time he doesn't as well. Dawkins, I think, comes off, I mean, you never know what's behind the scenes. Dawkins comes off as someone who really can't imagine this as being due to anything but credulity. Like, that's just ignorance and the inability to think. I mean, that's basically how his writing comes off. Most of the stuff I see kind of pop internet atheism, I think most of the atheism we encounter, I would say, is of this less honest sort in that sense. I mean, pop kind of apologetic internet atheists who read books published by Prometheus Press, I mean, that... Most of those that I've encountered, they're fairly confident in their view. They don't. I wouldn't characterize them as struggling that much with the other side. Literary atheists, perhaps, people who are atheists but who are writers of literature. My suspicion is, and I'm not thinking, and unfortunately, and this is embarrassing, I'm not thinking of any obvious name, though I know people have presented to me tons of these. I think tend to struggle with this more. Poets, my guess is literary writers, writers and poets would tend to, because they're tending to give they try to honor what it's like to experience these things. Their own experiences, and they don't try to reduce them to kind of just arguments. And so, yeah.
So along that pop culture, maybe I'm just confused, but can you define or clarify the difference between, let's say, maybe a star atheist and
So, a stark atheist.
Well, it doesn't even need to be that. How do you reconcile the two of this atheist, which is a non-belief per se, a higher being?
Right. So, in other words, people who believe that they themselves, like, kind of deify themselves, you know, maybe I'm being overly charitable. My reading of most atheists is not that they try to replace God with themselves. My reading is they often really do replace God with something more like the cosmos. And tend to feel some degree of, I mean, when you look at the titles of their books, like, you know, Richard Dawkins' book on evolution, The Greatest Show on Earth, the word wonder, Carl Sagan's Cosmos, there really is this sense of, like, something bigger than me of which I'm a part. Lyotard has this great quote in his account of knowledge that he wrote for the Quebecan government, I think, and he has this great statement that the Quebecan government spends millions of dollars every year trying to pass off science as epic. So science is a story. And so I think that religion, I mean, I think we could argue that what is like religion for them takes these other forms, and then their more like moral characteristics can tend to get caught up in justice movements. I mean, social justice movements have sometimes a very religious fervor. Certainly there's shallow versions of all of this, but my personal experience in my reading of most of the ones I read is that it doesn't tend to be a, well, God doesn't exist, therefore I'm God, woohoo, you know, any more than we do that ourselves. And you had a question? Yeah. You know, it's perhaps hard to fully get at that without thinking in terms of people's stories, but you know, silence. What do I mean when I say silence? I mean that sense that when somebody is desperate, that God show up, that nothing happens. I mean, I think a lot of us who pray struggle, especially in certain moments, with feeling like prayer is anything but me talking to the air. And it seems empty. It seems silent. And I think this is, I mean, a lot of the Psalms are this way. A lot of the Psalms are, hello, where are you? Here I am, I need help. I remember thinking you were helpful, but it doesn't seem so right now. What's going on? You know, that's, it's, And I, in those examples, I highly recommend the film The Gray. It's very fascinating. You know, Liam Neeson, you know, and again, it's like this beautiful background. So it's just really, it's really wonderful, sort of beautiful Alaskan wilderness. And him just saying, please, please, please do something. I'm so desperate. Nothing. And it's just, in other words, if God didn't exist, maybe one way of putting silence would be something like this. If God didn't exist, this is exactly what I'd expect the world to feel like. That's what that feels like. If God didn't exist, I would expect prayer to feel exactly what it feels like right now. And that's, I think that kind of captures what I mean by silence. Yeah.
Great. Well, that's, we're about that time.
All right.
So, thanks, Joe.
Yeah. Thank you.